Fry bread may be the most recognizable Native American food in the country today, but it's not a truly traditional part of any Native American culture. This hour, Native American food before the settlers came. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Chef Sean Sherman calls himself the Sioux Chef. That's Sioux spelled S-I-O-U-X. And he specializes in pre-colonization cuisine. He works as a caterer and a food educator in the Twin Cities. And I'll talk with him about the research he's done and the dishes he creates. I'll also talk with Kelly Schott, owner of Historical Pathways. She teaches classes in how to cook using traditional methods. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When European settlers arrived, that was the beginning of pretty much everything changing for the native people of what would become the United States. With overwhelming loss of land and lives, dietary changes may seem like a small thing, but food is an important part of culture, and many native groups lost their traditional foods along with nearly everything else. This hour, we're going to talk about Native American food culture, and my first guest today is Chef Sean Sherman. He calls himself the Sioux Chef, and that's S-I-O-U-X, and he specializes in pre-colonization cuisine. Chef Sean, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, you grew up on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. When you were growing up, was traditional food an important part of what you ate?
Yeah, I think during a lot of the gatherings that we would have, you know, pieces of traditional foods, we would have, you know, things like wojapi, which is just a berry sauce. Usually it was from chokecherry. We'd have stews. A lot of times we'd have tinsula, which is a kind of a wild prairie root that we would gather when we were kids out there also. We would, you know, my grandparents would make this soup called taniga, which was kind of a real simple soup made out of mostly like intestine and kind of stomach pieces. You know, and that was a little bit harder for me when I was younger, but, you know, I have a deeper appreciation for foods like that now that I'm older.
Well, I was just going to ask you, so as a kid, was this something that you looked forward to?
Maybe not so much the taniga, but, you know, the other stuff was really good.
When you ate these foods and saw them prepared by people in your family, were you curious about them as a child? Was this something you asked questions about?
You know, I think, yeah, it was fun to be outdoors and, you know, go and find some of the stuff. I remember, you know, going out and finding groves of chokecherry and just picking chokecherries for a whole afternoon. You know, and growing up a little bit later in life, you know, I started working in restaurants at a pretty young age, around 13, around the Black Hills of South Dakota. I did a little stint of working for the Forest Service also, where I was kind of, my job was to learn all the wild plants out there, which kind of helped me culinarily later. But, you know, I became really curious when I became a chef later in life and was really kind of questioning, you know, what was authentic Native American food? You know, what were the foundations? And that's kind of what set me on the path of trying to dig up a lot of this research.
You know, I mentioned earlier fry bread, which is something that a lot of people think of as a Native American food. It's something that came into Native American diets post-colonization because of the rations that were given to Native Americans after they were forced onto reservations. When you were growing up, was there kind of a dividing line in your mind about what is a traditional food and what is not a traditional food?
You know, not, I don't think I really had those thoughts until a little bit later in life when I was, you know, working directly with food, on a professional scale. I think anybody dealing with Native American food is going to have to come across the question about fry bread, and it doesn't take very long to figure out approximately when it came into the diet. But, you know, it's been so, it's such an integrated piece across, you know, Native America, all over the place. That you can't really dismiss it. It's just something that's, you know, not necessarily healthy for you, even though it tastes really good. You know, and for me, I chose to really concentrate on, you know, the other pieces of knowledge that were, seemed to me a lot more interesting and useful, like the, you know, plant identification and how people were preparing foods and, you know, there was a lot more to it than the fry bread piece, I think.
When you became a chef, was there a moment for you when you thought, I really want to go back and actually figure out what the cuisine of my people would have been like?
Yeah. You know, I came up with this idea quite a few years back. I want to say it was around 2006 or so. And I had this vision of doing a Native American cookbook focusing on just Lakota foods and focusing on just that region and that piece, you know, so really reaching back to my heritage. But, you know, when I started researching, I just really wasn't finding the information I needed because there wasn't, you know, a Joy of Native American Cooking cookbook out there that kind of detailed all of the information I needed. So I kind of had to devise my own education plan as to what, you know, I had to figure out what were the foundations of Native American food cuisine. You know, and for me, it was, you know, what people were growing, what the agriculture scene was like, the history of the regions and how people came to be where they are today. Food preservation, you know, saving up and preserving foods for winter and how they're producing foods to be able to be preserved. Salt and sugar making, trading routes, cooking techniques, plant identification, I think I said. But, you know, there was a whole bunch of pieces that were Native American foods. And those were the pieces that I started really looking for to be able to use for my own pantry.
And as you said, there was no Joy of Native American Cooking that you could turn to. What kinds of resources did you turn to try to reconstruct this?
Well, I think at first I started researching a lot of foraging books and really trying to get a sense of food or plant identification and really kind of being out there in the forests and the plains and looking actively for plants throughout the seasons, collecting them, playing with them and testing them and trying them and just getting to know them again. So, and really digging into, you know, books on ethnobotany of what plants were here, how people were utilizing them, and really trying to gain that experience on a personal level. And then, of course, tons of history books. And, you know, I got lucky finding books. There's one in particular called Buffalo Bird Woman's Garden, which is the chronicles a year in the garden from a Hidatsa woman's point of view, all pre-colonial. So it's her memories at the turn of the century growing up before she ever saw Europeans and how they were fashioning their tools, what kind of seeds they were growing, how they were doing it, what they were doing with the foods, how they were getting ready for winter. You know, so finding some really awesome chronicles like that really helped me along too, especially for this region that I'm particularly focused on, which was just, you know, since I'm in Minnesota, I've been really focused on Dakota and the Ojibwe styles. Because I just really wanted to show people how diverse and varied Native American food systems are. So you can't really just say this is a typical Native American dish because it changes from region to region across the entire North American continent.
Well, I was just going to ask you that. Between the different tribes, the different cultures, I mean, how much variance is there when it comes to food?
Yeah, there's a lot, you know, for even, you know, between the Ojibwe and the Dakota, even though they're in the same area, there's a lot of variances in even between Dakota and Lakota, for example, too, you know, because the Dakota were over here where it's really foresty and lots of lakes, and the Lakota, you know, for quite a few generations were around the plains and moving around the Black Hills, and, you know, they're spread out quite a bit bigger. So the food systems were different. And then, you know, you get further into the Rockies, you go onto the West Coast where it's completely different over there and the foods are different. So it just keeps changing. You know, the Southwest is completely different and, you know, all the little areas of the Southwest are different from each other. So there's so much variety out there. So I just really wanted to kind of get people to think about Native American food systems and how different they are just because the regions of the United States are so vast and different also.
I've interviewed other people who have worked on trying to recreate historical recipes, and one of the problems that people run into all over the world is that history is often written from the perspective of men and about men's lives, and what women were doing in the kitchen is not something that many people took the time to document and record. Is that a problem that you also ran into?
Definitely. So a lot of the first... you know, I looked through lots of history books of what people were seeing when they're first meeting up with, you know, peoples and writing about it and how they were experiencing it. So, and a lot of times it was about how the men were out hunting and following them around, and not at all how the women were doing all of the work in the background, you know, breaking down the animals and, you know, processing the meats and doing the vegetables and like everything, you know, was done that way. So that's why I like that book in particular. Buffalo Bird Woman's Garden was a great perspective because it was a female perspective. And, you know, she, you know, had that deep connection with food that she was taught since she was a little girl. So, you know, it's, but there's not a lot of gems out there like that.
It seems like it would be one thing to get an idea of what kinds of foods were eaten and prepared, and something else entirely to figure out how those things were prepared and how they would have tasted. How have you gone about trying to figure out what kind of flavor profile these dishes would have had?
Well, for me, it was kind of recreating those winter pantries. So what people were putting in their food caches and what kind of flavors were they using and what were they seasoning things with? And then using all of these flavor profiles to build the pantry that I utilize moving forward to serve food to the public. You know, so we're using all sorts of flavors. You know, we use pine and spruce tips and, you know, things like that from the trees. We use lots of wild herbs and wild gingers and, you know, flowers. And then, you know, of course, all of these heirloom varieties of seeds that are we're slowly being able to grow out again. So heirloom varieties of beans and squash and melon and corn.
We seem to, you're cutting out a little bit on us. Sean, can you hear me?
Yeah, I totally can.
Okay, good.
Okay.
So one of the interesting things about Native American cuisine, and as you mentioned, I mean, it would vary a lot from tribal group to tribal group, but this also is a cuisine that arose out of necessity and out of, you know, the need to stay alive and healthy through the winter months. So when we're thinking about, you know, using spices or using different things that would be in that food cache, there also would have had to be the consideration of we need to live through the winter. So is that something that you try to take into consideration as well, trying to maybe not use too much because there wouldn't have been a lot of something?
Definitely. I think that, you know, the building of the food caches was something that was a year-round process pretty much, you know. So around this area, it would start in the springtime with the gathering of maple and making maple sugar. And then it goes throughout the whole season. You're growing out your vegetables, you're collecting stuff from the forest. There's berry season after berry season, and you're constantly preserving everything. And, you know, the main ways of preserving were sun drying, smoking, basically, and grinding things into powder and then storing them like that. So, you know, for me, it was just kind of really trying to figure out what all those pieces were. Because there's so many pieces, and you know, I've been able to figure out an entire restaurant plan of just Dakota Ojibwe food styles off of these pieces.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Chef Sean Sherman. He owns a business called The Sioux Chef. That's S-I-O-U-X. He specializes in pre-colonization cuisine. He's a caterer and a food educator. And we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Native American cuisine. And with me is Chef Sean Sherman. He owns a business called The Sioux Chef. Again, I'll spell it S-I-O-U-X. And he specializes in pre-colonization cuisine. He's a caterer and a food educator. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll also talk with Kelly Schott, who's owner of Historical Pathways. And she teaches classes on how to cook using traditional methods. You're also welcome to join our conversation. The number to call 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have a caller on the line, Jim in Spencer, with a question. Hi, Jim. Jim, are you there? Oh, we lost Jim. All right. Again, you can join our conversation, 866-780-9100. And Sean, when you have been doing this research and trying to create dishes using authentic ingredients and, you know, authentic spices, is preparing these dishes in a traditional way also an important part of the puzzle for you?
You know, for me, I just try like to keep it simple as it used to be. So, you know, I've been telling people it's kind of like the unmodernist cuisine, just because it's just a few ingredients. You know, and you know, we're not using any dairy or processed sugar or flour. I'm not even using beef, pork, or chicken. We just really wanted to try to, you know, keep the base and foundation of it as traditional as possible, and, you know, keep the styles really traditional too, as best as we can. Because I just kind of put myself in a box, like, you know, if I was here 300 years ago as a chef, you know, what could I do with all these foods that were around me, and kind of, and the styles that I can cook with, and really try to, you know, think of foods like that. You know, and I work out of a commercial kitchen, and, you know, we do it professionally, but, you know, I really try to keep the styles as simple as possible.
Can you describe one of the dishes that you make for us?
You know, I was just in Italy, so I was invited to Milan to cook at a James Beard restaurant a couple weekends ago, I guess. We just got back last week. But, you know, we just wanted to showcase, you know, some of the simple styles and some of these plates that we do. They're modern in composition on the plate, but the food itself is really simple. So it could be, you know, some smoked rabbit and some blueberry wojapi sauce and maybe a grilled corn cake and some fresh vegetables or some fresh greens, you know, something like some ramps, wild onions or something like that. And then, you know, build a really fun modern plate off of just these few flavors. But think of it like, you know, it's such a micro-regional plate, like you can walk around the forest within a mile radius and find all these ingredients. So it's kind of fun to put the plates together like that.
Is there something that you've made that has really just wowed you with the flavors you've been able to coax out of these simple ingredients?
I think just, you know, learning how to cook with, you know, especially as a professional chef, you know, you're so used to using European styles and binding things with flour and egg and making sauces thick with sugar and stuff like that. It's just thinking outside the box and like you really getting to know these foods for what they are. And, you know, being able to make simple breads with just vegetable meal, you know, be it, you know, we've dried and ground sunchokes or just using cornmeal and just making something so simple. So I think just really getting to know the food on a simple, intimate level has been, you know, really rewarding, and also really getting to know the foods around us in the forest and all these flavors that are always around us. So, you know, it's really fun to go for a walk and find a patch of something that, you know, it's only going to be there for a couple of weeks out of the year and be able to gather a whole bunch of it and do something with it so you can, you know, enjoy it for the rest of the year.
Why is it important for you to sort of keep yourself in that box? I can imagine as a professional chef that maybe there would be times when you're making a dish when you think, you know, cream would make this taste amazing, or if I could use butter, that would be terrific. Why is it important to you to not do that?
I think it's just the challenge of it. Number one, just the saying that we can do it, and just to show people that there is a really cool and indigenous cuisine out here. And, you know, it changes in style all over the board. So I think just, you know, staying true to that value for now is fun. You know, we can always fusionize things down the road. But I would rather see fusions of, you know, United States indigenous food. So maybe I could do fusions of, say, Hopi and Ojibwe, or, you know, Navajo and Lakota, compared to just French and everything. So,
do you find that there are a lot of people from different cultural backgrounds, different Native American cultural backgrounds, who are coming to you and saying, "Hey, you know, what did my ancestors eat?"
There's been a lot of interest. You know, I've gotten a ton of notice. We've had a lot of interviews and. So I've had a lot of press. I just started this business in September, and it's really been taking off pretty well. But there's been a real positive reception towards it. And I think it's something that people are interested in across the board. You know, we've been out to California, been out to the Black Hills, and, you know, there's a need for this all over the place for people to really, you know, look deeply into what Native American food systems are around them and how can we bring this to the public and how can we, you know, make these foods accessible to the public.
One of the very serious issues that came along with colonization and the change of Native American diets, I mean, there have been a lot of health issues that have arisen out of that change. And of course, the traditional or now traditional American diet brings with it a lot of health problems as well. But it's been a real scourge for Native American people. And I'm talking about, of course, obesity and type 2 diabetes. Is that an important part of this puzzle as well? Because clearly the foods that you're talking about are not going to cause those problems or contribute to those problems. Is this also an issue of health?
Yeah, definitely. Because health has been a huge issue in Native communities for a long time. But it wasn't always like that. You know, before, when people are on their traditional diets, the best part about this food that we're messing with and playing with and recreating, it's just really healthy, clean, super regional food. And it's really low on the glycemic scale, which I think is the best part about it. Because it was topping out in the 30s or something like that average with these really, with this kind of diet. And then after people were kind of moved on to higher sugars and fats and flours and things like that, you know, that glycemic scale rose way up into the 90s, 80s on averages. And it really affected a lot because, you know, before people were, you know, they weren't seeing tooth decay as an issue. There was no obesity. There was no type 2 diabetes. There was no heart disease. And it's all diet related, you know, but some Native communities, they might have just a convenience store, and 90% of the foods on the shelves are going to be filled with sugar and preservatives and, you know, fat and salt. And it's just, you know, really unhealthy stuff. So, you know, a lot of Native communities or even non-Native communities, you know, switch to this kind of traditional Native American diet, you know, I think there would be really great health benefits involved with that.
I'm talking with Chef Sean Sherman. He is the sous chef, and he has a business in the Twin Cities. He specializes in pre-colonization cuisine. He caters. He also educates. And you're welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. Jim is back on the line in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Hey, hi.
Good. What's your question?
Yeah. Well, I had a couple, actually. But first of all, I read that the Sioux were known to have rooted up a thistle, I guess they called it artichoke, and I just wasn't sure if you knew about that, had tried it, or exactly which thistle that might be. And then the other thing I was thinking about as I was, you know, just listening was honey. I've been told that the Sioux and most Indians wouldn't consume that. They didn't think it was edible. Are you familiar with that?
All right.
Yep.
So
Sorry.
No, I was going to say maybe we should start with the artichoke question. Is that something that rings a bell?
You know, it could be the Jerusalem artichoke, possibly, which is the sunchoke, you know, which grows wild all over the place. And we use that pretty heavily. It's just it's a nice, you know, almost potato-like root, really. And I know there's some thistles out there that are edible, so I guess I just have to, you know, kind of research to see which one they might be thinking in particular.
All right. And then honey?
As far as the honey question goes, yeah, I couldn't find any research stating people utilizing honey as a food source. But I think moving forward, you know, in the modern world, that I feel like honey is pretty adaptable because it really, you know, creates a lot of positive in your environment. And it's a great low glycemic sweetener also. So we use honey, not as much as maple. I use a lot more maple and birch syrup as a sweetener. But I've included honey with a lot of the dishes that I do. I just feel like it's fine to modernize a little bit here and there.
Well, and that brings up so many interesting questions. Have there been some things like honey that you've thought, oh, I can use that, and then you start researching and find out no?
Well, there's a few things that, you know, especially researching plants, of which plants were indigenous and which plants weren't. But, you know, I include dandelion nowadays and burdock root and things like that because they are all around us now today. And I feel like looking at these food systems through indigenous perspective, you know, is it something that's food? Is it something that's medicine? Or is it something that's industrial that we can utilize? And a lot of times it's all three, you know, because a lot of these foods were medicine for everybody beforehand, too. And they have, you know, medicinal attributes to them. So I just really try to think positively and moving forward, and I don't want to stick myself in a time frame. I'm only using indigenous foods from the years 1550 to 1750. You know, I wanted to open myself up a little bit more than that. So I am including things like dandelion that have come around. I am including things like honey that's all around us today. I am including things like apples, that of different varieties, and even some of the foods that the native farms are producing, even though they're not indigenous. You know, I'm still promoting economic growth on these native farms by being able to purchase some of the vegetables and vegetation that they're growing and utilize them also.
Let's take another call. Kevin is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, Well, I'm wondering if you see an affinity between Joe Robinson's book, Eating on the Wild Side, and what you're doing as far as, you know, anti-inflammatory properties, anti-cancer properties, anthocyanins, this whole new category of chemistry research out of native foods or natural foods.
You know, I think that what we're doing, it's hitting a lot of different groups all over the place. And I think, you know, eating wild, of course, is extremely healthy. You know, it can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. And, you know, you know, we just try to be conscious about how much we're foraging and taking out of the land, too. So being respectful at the same time. But I think that a lot of these wild foods are so, you know, so potent, and they've got a ton of, you know, positive attributes towards them with, for our health-wise. And there's a lot of other parallel researchers out there doing work. You know, mine just happens to be more focused on, you know, the indigenous. And I think that the health benefits are just an added bonus to a lot of the work that I'm doing.
Kevin, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And I want to bring Kelly Schott into the conversation now. She's the owner of Historical Pathways, and she teaches classes on how to cook using traditional methods. She's also the program coordinator for the Meskwaki Natural Resources staff. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, ma'am.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here and thrilled. Thank you.
Now, where does your interest in this kind of cooking come from?
It came from my background. It's just an interest in historical cooking and in history in general, and being in the natural resource field most of my life, it just has kind of come to me, and this is just kind of the path I've taken.
Now, one of your focuses is not just cooking traditional Native American foods, but also using traditional methods. Why is that of interest to you?
Because I do a lot of the historical cooking, the historical food substances along those lines. To me, that speaks and informs people of the utilitarian side of Native American history. You know, we're all very familiar with, you know, the history in the 1800s along those lines, but we don't really get the insight into how people actually cooked at that time period prior to that. And to me, that's the human side, and that's what draws me in.
And what area of the country do you focus on with your research? I mean, you focus primarily on woodland culture?
Correct, yes.
And not necessarily prehistoric. We were talking about pre-colonization, which is not exactly the same thing as prehistoric, although there aren't a lot of written records from pre-colonization times. So you're focusing more on a little bit later period where there have been a lot more records kept.
Yeah, there was. There's a lot more. I focus primarily on the 1750 to about 1800. And then when I go to some historic sites, it can go up to about 1830. And my research is based on primary documentation, such as, you know, the Jesuit record. When the Jesuits were here, they were the first people, Europeans, I should say, to have kind of an interaction with the Native American cultures that were here. And they left a lot of records of what food was being cooked, how people preserved that food, how they cooked it, what they cooked with, and what they were eating. So,
what kinds of utensils do you use when you cook?
People laugh. It's like, that's a piece of bark. And I'm like, well, yeah. Because if you have to think about it, we didn't have plates. People didn't have pewter. Wooden bowls were used primarily, along with large pieces of planking. And again, that would be ash, and it would be hickory planking. You know, when you're drying fish, again, you know, oak and hickory planking. So a lot of it is very natural and very historically accurate as possible.
And how do you get these historically accurate pieces?
Oh, there's a lot of different venues. You can produce the items yourself. There's actually a lot of vendors out there now that are getting into and have been in for many years reproducing historical accurate reproductions. These are for museums as well as for tribal entity use. And, for example, Ward Olds, who owns at the Eastern Door, he makes beautiful bowls, feast bowls, traditional spoons, ladles, all those lines, and he makes them by hand. So if I can't make something, I can know I can go out to a vendor and purchase it.
Can you tell me about something that you've tried to make that maybe was a particular challenge for you?
Yeah, I use traditional clay pots from about the 1730s, 1750. And I keep them to a very specific tribal region and focusing on maybe Sauk or Meskwaki. And so trying to cook in a clay pot, I'm not going to go get a pot that would have been a representative of the Potawatomi or the Ho-Chunk. So trying to find a representation of that pottery is very specific. A friend of mine makes it in Wisconsin, so I bring that in and cook with it. And that pot's a little bit different in how it was created because they didn't use shell as part of the grist to hold the clay together. So cooking in a pot and a clay pot over a fire is very interesting because it's not real thick and it's not like a clay, not like a copper kettle or a brass trade kettle. So you've got to be real careful in how you even warm it up. You've got to warm it at the side of the fire and then turn it around till the whole pot is warm. And you got to make sure you already have the water in there, and because if you add cold water to it, your pot's going to explode. So cooking in a traditional clay pot has been very interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like an incredible challenge. And Sean, I completely understand why you don't listening to this. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guests are Chef Sean Sherman. He's the sous chef. He specializes in pre-colonization cuisine, and he caters and also does food education in the Twin Cities. Kelly Schott is here with me. She's owner of Historical Pathways. She teaches classes in how to cook using traditional methods in Iowa. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join us, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Native American foods. And with me, Chef Sean Sherman. He's the sous chef. He specializes in pre-colonization cuisine. He grew up on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. He now lives in the Twin Cities and has a catering business, also does food education. Also, Kelly Schott is here. She's owner of Historical Pathways, and she teaches classes in how to cook using traditional methods. And Sean, talking with Kelly about some of those clay pots before the break, it makes me think about so many of the different kinds of foods that you incorporate in Native American food. You mentioned maple syrup or birch syrup, and the fact that Native American people figured out that they could get something sweet from the sap of a maple tree, and without all of the techniques that we can use today to make maple syrup, they were able to make maple syrup. I mean, sometimes do you just marvel over the fact that anybody was able to figure this out in the first place?
Definitely. I think, and you know, it's usually breaking it all the way down into maple sugar was the biggest form and the biggest staple. But, you know, people making salt from salt springs, or creating a hominy by nixtamalizing corn, by, you know, creating a lye water and, you know, releasing the, you know, and just basically making hominy and just having some of these, you know, kind of difficult processes of producing foods. I think it's super cool that people were just doing that as an everyday part of life for many millennia.
Well, and so many people who have tried subsistence living in the modern world have found that they have a really hard time meeting all of their nutritional needs. That's something else that fascinates me, is that this cuisine does meet all of your nutritional needs.
Yep, it's true. And, you know, a lot of Native American people and people with the Native American heritage, you know, the genes were different, so they were actually breaking down the sugars differently. So they didn't need that high sugar, fast energy kind of food. They were able to, you know, kind of like a feast or famine kind of a gene, where they were able to store a lot of energy with not having to eat a lot of these foods. So I think that's what, you know, when it came to this European diet that affected them even more, with this extremely high rate of type 2 diabetes, obesity, heart disease, on all sorts of other complications that come along from that kind of diet. So I think, you know, getting back towards these traditional foods is, you know, it's really going to be great for a lot of communities.
And in thinking about, Kelly, using some of these traditional cooking methods, is this something that you can do on a practical level?
Yeah. At home, actually, I do kind of use some of my clay pots in the oven. And I know that's incorporating historical now with more of a modern cooking. But, yeah, to cook to cook meat in a clay pot. The Italians are using a lot of clay cookery nowadays to cook. Pampered Chef is a prime example. Stoneware, you know, the pizzas you're cooking on, all that. Those are all taken from historical uses of clay use.
And Sheila from Elizabeth, Illinois has a similar question that she's wondering about. Hi, Sheila.
Hello there. Hi. I think my question was virtually identical. And I was just wondering, Kelly, whether you have found that in teaching traditional methods, whether people do incorporate the methods as well as the foods into their ordinary everyday cooking. I think that's virtually the same question that you've already been asked.
I've actually found that people actually kind of reverse it. They want to know how to cook what they classify as modern food in a more historical manner. I have had people, yeah, it's kind of a reverse. I'll be cooking a soup in a clay pot or cooking some buffalo along those lines, and they want to know how to apply the utilization of those traditional cooking wares in their home use. And I have seen people cooking bacon and eggs in clay pots.
But yeah. Why would people want to do that, do you think?
I don't know. I think it's more of a challenge on a culinary skill to see if I can use something historical and adopt it to a modern use at home. And then in the process, maybe pulling back from that historical knowledge and carrying that forward.
Well, Sheila, thank you so much for your call. Randy's on the line next in Iowa County. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Is either one of you going to do any kind of workshops in the 2015 that if we live close enough, we may be able to come and enjoy your wisdom?
Good question, Randy. And Kelly, I'll let you answer that first, since I know that you teach courses in Iowa. Do you have anything coming up that people could be a part of?
Yes, we're looking at doing one in Linn County for the Linn County Conservation Department, and I think that's going to be sometime in the fall. And then I do some stuff at the Apple River Fort, which is in Illinois, and kind of periodically at some other historic sites.
All right. And I think Kelly may have just dropped off the line. We'll get her back in just a moment. Sean, I'll ask you, though. I mean, as a caterer and a food educator, do you teach classes? Do you teach people how to make this food?
Yep. We've been doing a lot of educational outreach. I've been traveling around quite a bit. As far as Iowa goes, I know I don't have anything upcoming too soon. I'll be in Lincoln, Nebraska in August, I believe. And people can check out my website, you know, to see if there's any information. We're around the city quite a bit. So, yeah, we do quite a bit. And, you know, I'm working on a cookbook that's kind of detailing a lot of these Native American food systems that we talked about before and just kind of, you know, creating my own Joy of Native American cookbook for people to utilize.
Is it important to you to make sure that as you're putting these things together, you're also giving credit to the tribe that this kind of food would have come from? We talked about all of the differences earlier.
Definitely, yep. And I really want to, you know, for people to understand, you know, the regionality and where people are and which groups are where and how they were doing things. So it really kind of makes a huge difference.
Who is coming to you and asking you to teach courses at this point? I know your business is fairly new and word's just getting out, but I'm curious about where demand is right now.
You know, I've been going to a lot of conferences. I've been getting invited to a few different kind of food sovereignty type conferences and farming conferences. I've been going to a lot of the schools around the Minneapolis-St. Paul area and just talking about, you know, this version of Native American food history and where it's at today. But, you know, there's a lot of interest in, you know, like I said, being invited to Milan was a big honor and to talk about it to kind of a bigger, we were at the World's Fair, actually. So it was, you know, kind of a bigger, much bigger audience,
right,
to get people to think about Native American food.
As a caterer, who is coming to you and asking you to make this kind of food for their events?
It's kind of all over the board. You know, we have some weddings coming up. We have lots of small groups. We have workshop meetings. We've got corporate lunches. We've got a lot of requests. You know, and right now we're opening up a food truck in about 2 weeks called Tatanka Truck in the Minneapolis area. And we're going to be, you know, serving this, you know, pre-colonial style foods, but kind of on a fun basis. So we're looking forward to that project a lot.
Yeah, that sounds really exciting. Kelly, let me ask you, if people come to you to learn about these traditional methods of making food. Who seems to be interested in this? What is your audience?
My audience ranges, you know, from young children to older adults, and I get a lot of people that are young people now, and when I'm saying that, I'm probably about early 20s to about the early 30s, wanting to get back to a more healthy diet, wanting to know more traditional cooking methods and utilizing, you know, the methods, and that includes like cooking with bear grease, and moving into copper, moving in with cooking with brass along those lines. So that seems to be the market. And as John was saying, there's a big movement of people wanting to get back to traditional foods and into that more health-related path.
We're talking about Native American food this hour. My guest, Chef Sean Sherman, specializes in pre-colonization cuisine. Kelly Schott is owner of Historical Pathways, and she teaches classes in how to cook using traditional methods. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Kelly, I know not only do you try to use traditional kinds of cookware, but you also try to get your hands on traditional kinds of ingredients, like specific kinds of corn or beans. Can you tell me a little bit about what you've researched there?
Most of my research comes from primary sources such as journals, historical records along those lines, and then various tribal historical documents as well. Utilize a lot of beans, a lot of the different varieties of corn, and I use traditional Indian corn, and that's not the ornamental corn that you buy, you know, at the food stands or along the roadside. I use, for example, I use a couple varieties of Flint corn and then dent corn. I use bear grease, bear oil. I use deer tallow. I utilize rabbits and fish. I try to buy and purchase, if not hunting on my own, get the traditional food stocks so that I can cook in the traditional methods and show people that it can be done and it is very tasty.
And do you grow some of your own ingredients?
Yes, I do. I've been an avid gardener for, oh my Lord, we won't even go into how many years. But yeah, I grow the traditional, what they would call the Three Sisters garden, which has the corn, the squash, and various forms of beans.
Is it getting easier to find some of the kinds of seeds that you're looking for?
I will say it is. A lot of tribal entities are becoming a little more open to sharing some of their seed sources or their traditional seed stock. The Cherokee or the Tuslagi down in the Georgia and Florida area have got a very wonderful seed-saving program within their own tribal entity. And this incorporates that each of the families donate 5 seeds from each of their plants. So if something happens to the family, those seeds are still there, and the records are still there, and that seed and plant can be brought back. Now, some of those seeds are being shared with the outside world. Seed Savers and Decora, for example, has gotten 3 new seeds that came in from the Meskwaki last year, which is just absolutely wonderful. So these seeds, like I said, are being shared with the outside world, and it's nice to see because it ensures that that seed and that plant won't be lost.
Sean, when you're looking for ingredients, I mean, you talked about foraging yourself. Obviously, you've got a full plate, so you can't do all of your ingredient sourcing on your own. Where do you get your ingredients?
Well, like I said, I'm working really closely with a couple of local native farms here in Minnesota. One's Dream Wild Health, and one is called Wojupi, and that one's run by the Midwakaden Sioux. And, you know, they work really closely to a lot of these food sovereignty groups, like Seed Savers and such, and are starting to grow out some of the fun varieties of beans and corns that we're just going to keep growing out more and more every year to be able to utilize and have more access to. You know, and meats are easy because it's, you know, I'm not using any beef, pork, or chicken, but I'm using fish from Red Lake Reservation up in northern Minnesota, so I can get walleye and whitefish and northerns and things like that on a consistent basis. We use a lot of bison and rabbit, and all of it's locally grown. So there's a lot of cool resources for foods out there.
In the research that you've done, I mean, here in Iowa, we have one of the most altered landscapes in the United States, and South Dakota, I'm sure, also a very altered landscape. Are there any plants that you have read about that just don't seem to exist anymore?
You know, it's hard to say because I'm sure there's been a, I'm sure there was quite a few varieties of seeds and things that went extinct. But, you know, I don't know personally which ones those are because I'm just kind of learning as I go. You know, it's going to be a lifelong learning process for me to, you know, continually find new pieces and talk with more people and understand more and more as I go forward. So, yeah, it's really I'd be really curious to know some of those pieces, but you know, off the top of my head, I don't know any of them.
Is there something that you haven't been able to make yet that is one of your goals?
I think just having more access to some of these pieces, you know, because seasons come and go so quickly. So, you know, chokecherries might be in force, but some seasons might be bad. And just having, you know, being able to get a good crop of things, you know, because I'm using a lot of wild rose hips during the late summer that I can pick myself and, you know, some of those easy pieces like sumac and just, you know, trying to gather these herbs and flavors so I can utilize them more and more to really showcase Native American food flavors. But it's really just having access to them. So I know which foods I can get on a year-round basis. So I'm not going to have problems finding maple or cornmeal or beans or squash and things like that. But, you know, I'm not going to have a huge supply of some of these specialty pieces.
Are there foods that are traditional Native American foods, pre-colonization foods, that we still find in the American diet today?
Well, I mean, I think it's representative of lots of pieces. You know, if you look at grits, that's pretty much Native American style of, you know, putting cornmeal in water and real simplistic like that. And maple syrup again, you know, and making a berry sauce. Dried meats, even jerky or, you know, barbecue for, you know, smoking meats, you know, are also styles that Native Americans were using, of course. So I think it's all around us if we look at it because, you know, people might think Native American food is something really exotic. But I tell people here in Minnesota, it's just you can't really get more Minnesotan than these flavors because they've just been here for such a long time. So it's just getting people to really think about these flavors that's all around them.
I interviewed a man named Dan Barber, who's the author of a book called The Third Plate, not that long ago. And he was talking his frustration. He doesn't feel there is an American cuisine because he believes that cuisine doesn't just represent a culture or a region, but it's also born out of need and it's sustainable. And he says that what we might call American cuisine was born out of plenty and involves a lot of waste as well. But what you're talking about is a true American cuisine. Is that how you would define it?
I think that there should be many Native American restaurants across the country to showcase how regional and diverse the United States are. You know, there should be more than none for sure. But, you know, I think we do have a really great American cuisine that has been here for a long time. And this isn't, you know, like the paleo diet where it's going back to some uncertain time. This is just, you know, I'm just researching the foods of my great-grandfather, so it's only a few generations back. But, you know, this food is, you know, such a cultural identifier for people, and I think we really need to understand them and, you know, show how diverse and regional all Native American foods are. It would be great to see Native American restaurants across the country just to show that diversification.
And for people who are traveling this summer, when will your food truck, Tatanka truck, be open?
Oh, we're almost there. It's about 2 weeks out. We're just getting graphics on it right now, and we're hiring all the people and getting starting the training, and we're ready to roll out the door. So we'll be at many events across the city, and we'll be hitting the streets and just, you know, having fun with it.
All right. Chef Sean Sherman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sean Sherman is the sous chef. He has a catering business, and he's a food educator in the Twin Cities area. And Kelly Schott, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Kelly Schott, owner of Historical Pathways. She teaches classes on how to cook using traditional methods in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.